Hi, everyone, and welcome to Climate Proofers, the show all about those on the front lines of adaptation finance, tech, and policy. I'm Louis Woodall, editor of the Climate Proof newsletter, which you can read at www.climateproof.news. Long-standing listeners to this pod probably think they have a good handle on the different types of climate risks that are plaguing our planet. Worse storms? Check. Longer droughts? Check. More frequent and devastating wildfires? Double check. But there are many, many other climate risks lurking beneath the headlines, some of which may prove even more economically costly than the nightmarish natural disasters that dominate our TV screens. This is true of pests, invasive species, and biological risks, or PIB risks. This covers an array of threats to agriculture, food systems, infrastructure, and public health from miniature beasties, like the mountain pine beetle, the spotted lanternfly, and the zebra mussel. A recent study in Perspectives in Ecology and Conservation found that biological invasions caused over $467 billion worth of damages between 1980 and 2019 in the US alone, more than the losses from wildfires, floods, droughts, or freezes. And these costs are only likely to spiral higher as climate change alters the habitable conditions for pests and encourages invasive species into new environments that are ill-prepared for their arrival. However, despite this huge and growing threat, PIB is an undercapitalized vertical in the adaptation investment landscape. Today's guest, Will Everall, is hoping to change all that. He's the founder of Uproot Capital, an adaptation VC and angel syndicate looking to invest in early-stage companies getting to grips with PIB risks. We talk about how Uproot came to be, get some hard and fast facts from Will on the scale of the PIB problem, and hear about some of the innovative solutions in this space that he's excited about. For all of those curious how creepy crawlies are creating new risks amidst the changing climate, this is the episode for you. Before we get started, a few housekeeping notes. First off, this will be the last regular episode of Climate Proofers for 2025. Thank you to everyone for listening this year, and never fear, we'll be back in mid-January with more adaptation conversations. To keep your ears happy, though, I have a special debate episode to share in the run-up to the holidays between myself and friend of the pod, John Robinson, where we argue about adaptation's so-called price tag dilemma. That is, whether all the talk of an adaptation finance gap is actually frustrating efforts to tackle climate risks. It may be the start of a whole new series. Maybe I should call it Adaptation Arguments. Let me know your thoughts via email or LinkedIn. And second of all, I couldn't let you go without one more heartfelt request for listeners to consider becoming paid Climate Proof members. We're so close to 250 total members, and hitting that milestone before the clock strike midnight on the 31st would really make my New Year special. So please, if you have the wherewithal and want to support independent adaptation news, insights, and data, head over to www.climateproof.news/upgrade to become a member now. Right, that's enough of all that. In a minute, my conversation with Will, but first, a roundup of last week's top adaptation and resilience stories. In finance, a new report issued by a European Commission reflection group is urging policymakers to create better conditions for private and public financing of climate resilience. The authors call for clearer rules on land use, tighter infrastructure standards, and more widely available climate risk information. They also want to see a scale-up of joint public-private financing tools, such as blended finance, resilience bonds, and guarantees, to support climate adaptation projects. The Reflection Group's report will inform the design of the EU-wide Climate Resilience and Risk Management Initiative, which opened for public consultation on December the 1st. In policy, the authors of a high-profile study estimating the global economic losses from climate change have retracted their findings after peers identified methodological flaws. The original calculations had factored into influential scenarios used by policymakers and financial watchdogs. The paper, published in Nature in April 2024, projected a 19% hit to global income by 2050. In response to scrutiny by US and German researchers, the authors lowered this estimate to 17% this August. However, the process revealed that calculation issues were too fundamental to resolve through a simple amendment, leading to the study being pulled. The paper had been widely cited by institutions including the World Bank, OECD, and central banks within the network for greening the financial system. In a statement, the NGFS said it had already added a disclaimer noting the controversy and stressed that its scenarios illustrate plausible pathways, not forecasts. And in tech, climate adaptation startup Rhizome has struck a partnership with National Grid to help the company harden its transmission networks against fast-growing wildfire threats. Through the initiative, Rhizome, which recently closed a $6.5 million seed round, will implement its Grid Firm platform across National Grid's service territories. The goal is to map wildfire ignition risks across the company's assets in Massachusetts, New York, and the UK. Rhizome technology will also support the utility in developing cost-effective wildfire prevention and response strategies. Right, that's it for this week's roundup. Now onto my conversation with Will. Hi, Will. Where are you calling from today and what do you do?
Hi, my name is Will Everall. I'm calling from London. I'm currently building and managing Uproot Capital, a boutique climate adaptation venture fund, your syndicate investing in pests, invasive species and biological technologies.
Thanks for being here, Will. Really appreciate you taking the time. And I wanted to speak to you because you're exploring this interesting vertical in climate adaptation tech, PIB, pests, invasive species and biological. And I really want to dig into this because, as you've mentioned, this is a kind of overlooked aspect of climate risk and of adaptation. So I really wanted to find out how you're thinking about it, how investors are thinking about this theme, and what cool technologies are out there that can address some of these risks. Perhaps we should start with Uproot Capital, first and foremost. Can you explain what your investment thesis is, what kinds of companies you're looking to invest in, and at what stage of growth? Are you targeting little baby companies or trying to go for some bigger fish?
Sure. So we're very new. We've only started in September and had some planning in the months prior to that. Our investment thesis really is quite simple. We're building a portfolio of early stage companies that are leveraging technology to help their clients deal with PIB or PIB risk. We're looking at two types of technology effectively that fall into two buckets, DX and RX. So on the DX side, you're looking at prediction, detection, testing and monitoring technologies. And on the RX side, control and remediation. PIB, sort of solutions to PIB risk have been around for a while now, incumbent chemical solutions, specialty chemistry, agriculture, both in row and specialty, you have things like sticky traps, which are manual. However, with mounting climate pressures, we need new solutions coming through that are better, faster, and cheaper than incumbents. So on the DX side, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it, is our sort of philosophy going into this. Technologies like genomic sequencing, eDNA, the RNA, smart traps, IoT sensors, AI, advanced analytics, SaaS-based dashboards to keep track and collate everything, and then sort of Earth observation technologies as well. Anything that can do what traditional incumbents can do and offer solutions to are better, faster, and cheaper. On the RX side, once you've identified what the problem is, we're looking at control and remediation. This is specialty chemistry, biologics and biocontrol solutions, so both microbial, fungal, bacterial, viral, biochemicals, semiochemicals, so pheromones, biological pesticides, as well as sort of transgenics, plant and corporate products, so RNAi, editing of the genomic sequencing itself, robotic, mechanical removal, gene editing, and basically anything that can help manage this risk, again, better, faster, and cheaper than incumbent solutions. These all fit underneath an overall threat of PIB risk. We've identified that out of all of the natural disasters, PIB risk is the fastest growing, about 702% from the period of 1980 to 1990, from that period to 2019, compared to something like storms, which is 130%. And it's a great cornerstone piece by Anna J. Turbelin, who talks about this in Perspectives from Ecology and Conservation. And they're causing about $423 billion USD in damages every year. So that's the sort of macro factor affecting these new technologies. We're investing in early stage, so pre-seed and seed.
Wonderful. Great overview there. So when we talk about PIB risk, how is climate change itself kind of exacerbating these risks? You gave us the percentage increase there, but can you go into a little bit more detail about how a warming climate is making pest invasive species, threats to agriculture, threats to forestry more acute?
Sure. So a number of different ways. Warming temperatures are often increasing over wintering. So that means that effectively pest invasive species and biological risk would normally die off during the winter months. They're actually lasting through that and then they can reproduce more in the summer. You're also talking about globalization as well. So it's not all linked necessarily to climate change. Actually, there's five main factors causing this, which is globalization, land use, pollution, the wildlife trade, and climate change honestly itself. I think it's best to break it down versus pest, invasive species, and biological risk. So within pests, an example could be the mountain pine beetle, which is endemic to the US and North America. Roughly 100,000 square miles of trees have been killed in North America by this pest in the last 20 years. And the impact of climate change on it is that cold spells that used to kill them off have gone. Trees that are stressed from drought in the winter aren't able to cope and defend themselves as well when this pest comes in larger numbers. For invasive species, something like the spotted lanternfly is increasing with warming temperatures. Same with something like the zebra mussel in US waterways. For biological risk, ticks are a perfect example where climate change is creating warmer, more humid conditions and milder winters that allow ticks to be more active for longer periods. That's causing an increase in Lyme disease, and also that host species that are moving around more due to climate-induced change, rodents, birds, deer, are changing their ranges and bringing ticks into human contact more often. So it depends on the risk and it depends on the sort of nuances of climate change. Another one to add in could be locusts falling under our category, if you will. Increased rainfall and extreme weather events from the Indian Ocean are causing rapid vegetational growth, sort of providing an abundant food source for locusts and allowing the population to explode. This is in places like West Africa, which is really affecting agricultural produce there.
Terrific. Yes, really appreciate you going through some of those great examples. And being a New York resident, I'm very familiar with the spotted lanternfly in particular and how it's been a bit of a menace to our city. But yes, a menace to many aspects of the agriculture economy as well. And I kind of want to get into this framing of PIB and how it links with adaptation, because it seems to me like you're covering technologies and risks that have been kind of siloed away in other sort of venture capital theses, right? So like healthcare or health tech or agritech, for example, or advanced chemicals you talk about and genomic sequencing. This is very high science based investing. And I imagine it exists in other funds and other kind of investment frameworks. So how do you kind of reconcile this into as a climate adaptation play? And in your conversations with investors, potential investors so far, do they understand how PIB fits into the climate adaptation tech vertical? How are you framing this and how do you find investors are responding to that framing?
It's a good question. I mean, it sounds very esoteric in practice, and we realize that it's not a space that a lot of people are looking into. And one of the main discussions we're having with portfolio companies at the moment, or potential portfolio companies, as to say, is that they're actually relieved someone is looking at this space with sort of scalpel-like precision as they are operating in it. But it crosses a number of different fields that usually aren't grouped together. But us, also the fund, by drawing a sort of polygon around these different sectors, have been able to like a variety of deal flow to come through that wouldn't usually be grouped together, as I mentioned earlier, the sort of DXRX side. But the sectors we're servicing can range from about six core sectors, and this is constantly expanding as we build this out. Agriculture, both row and specialty crops, aquaculture, forestry and apiaries as the four there, conservation and biodiversity, public health and safety, industry and infrastructure, tourism and hospitality, and transportation and logistics are all facing escalated PIB risk within a changing climate. Going back to sort of the PIB risk acronym, I should probably draw a distinction between the different types of threats. So pests are essentially native organisms that are getting worse because of a changing climate. I mentioned the mountain pine beetle and the locust earlier, but something like jellyfish can also be considered a pest. Going back to the sectors that it's affecting, you're talking about jellyfish increasing reproductive rates in warming waters because they're more active. Actually, they're coming to the surface more, which means they're getting stuck in things like nuclear reactor cooling intakes. We saw a couple of instances with this in France recently, which sounds esoteric when you say to people, oh, jellyfish are affecting nuclear reactors, but actually it is something that we're seeing more often. And someone brought to my attention a story from New York Climate Week, which was, I believe it's Bruce Power, which was increasing fish spawns in the water intake, which shut down that particular facility. So that's getting worse with the changing climate. Invasive species are sort of non-native species that have moved through geographical lines, something like the zebra mussel, the spotted lanternfly, as I mentioned, and kudzu, which is the vine that ate the south. It's a sort of invasive weed that is really affecting infrastructure in the south of the US and moving up with a changing climate, high management costs, herbicide application, it's really difficult to get through. And then biological threats. This is probably the most visceral out of all of our categories. Things like mosquitoes, which are traditional public health problems. So you're talking Aedes, aegypti, Albopictus, Anopheles, mosquitoes, and Culex, which are the three main disease carrying. Things like dengue, Zika, chikungunya, malaria, West Nile virus. With these, it's rising temperatures and longer summer seasons, milder winters, and changes in rainfall patterns mean that they're producing more and they're actually migrating from tropical climates where they're usually found to places like the UK, the US, and increasingly in the south of Europe in the Mediterranean environment. Usually a health care risk, as I mentioned, but underneath this framing, they become a sort of pest invasive species and biological problem. Pesticide resistance is increasing as developing nations struggle to control them. And we're seeing actually in the UK through a couple of early detection methods, Asian tiger mosquito has now been found in Kent and Surrey, I believe, last year. These are PIB risks, threats, that when grouped together by the different industries they're affecting, they become less esoteric and they become something quite concrete that investors can see are affecting industry and society. And our job at Uproot Capital is to build a portfolio of solutions that can help deal with them better than incumbents, better, faster, and cheaper, as I mentioned before. It is an exercise in communication, I will admit. It's not a traditional climate tech realm, especially not on the mitigation side. We are not a fund, sort of a happy, clappy climate tech fund, if you will, that's sort of saving the environment, ecology. This is more of a fund about survival, lives and livelihoods, both from the public health standpoint and also economically as well. People are being damaged by these pest species. If we can get that message across to investors, I believe more will come around to our side of the table and we'll see what we're working on as a serious project. PIBs is a serious threat.
I see that you are probably the only fund I've encountered that is talking explicitly about PIB risk as this category, right? And that's why I kind of made the point about how do you explain to investors how you differentiate from, you know, agri-tech, from health tech, etc. So I wanted to get into, like, how do you find building the sector, right? What have you found that works to help educate potential investors and indeed founders themselves who might not realize actually their solutions are climate adaptation tech? Can you talk about how you're sort of like building the market, creating education and creating awareness around PIB risk?
Well, I mean, by our grouping of those different industries, so just to remind you again, agribusiness, conservation, biodiversity, public health and safety, industry and infrastructure, tourism, hospitality, and transportation logistics, it's all about tying them together through common PIB risks that they're facing. The problem with pest invasive species and biological risks are they are less visceral than traditional climate threats. So things like storms, earthquakes, extreme temperatures even. And it's up to us to sort of educate people on how serious an issue this is. The concept of invasion debt, I think, is particularly interesting in explaining this. So with builders in the space and investors, so the spotted lanternfly, again, which we alluded to earlier as a sort of New York, I'm sure you know it well, but actually was first spotted in the US in 2014 in Pennsylvania. And it's all about how today's established invaders are sort of decades old arrivals into countries. Recent arrivals haven't actually manifested yet. Some sort of natural disasters can create large impacts in seconds, heat waves, floods, and they're more visceral because of that. But the impact of invasions is much more complex and only becomes sort of fully manifest decades after their introduction when invaders are sort of well established. We're talking about this with varroa mites and bee colony collapse. So it's about us educating people that this is a real threat. It's not as visceral as some of these other climate risks, but it is just as expensive, as I mentioned before, and has increased on the same level as these other natural disasters, if not more. I mean, and our positioning as a fund in the space, we realize we're boutique. We realize we're very niche and nuanced, and not everyone is going to get what we're working on, and that's fine. But those practitioners in the space that do, those in agribusiness, those in your traditional sort of pest control companies, Rentokil, Anti-Cemex, Rollins, Terminix, all recognize the sort of work we're doing and work we're building on. And they recognize the need for innovation coming through that can help replace incumbent solutions that are increasingly less effective in a changing climate.
Brilliant. And I want to come back to climate adaptation tech as its own theme, its own sector in a little bit. But I want to take a step back now and ask a little bit more about you, Will, and what your journey's been towards starting Uproot Capital. What's your background in climate? And I suppose what set of skills or experiences or learnings do you think make you well suited to be kind of the face of this Uproot Capital fund?
Sure. I mean, I'll preface and say I'm very new to the space. My background is in climate tech networking, media and sales. I was part of a media and events company that used to connect investors sort of later stage with founders at Series A, B level climate tech traditionally on the mitigation side. Really enjoyed that. So it was fascinating. I got to travel a lot. I got to meet a lot of investors, both VCs, LPs, venture capital funds, as well as sovereign wealth funds, family offices. And the startups themselves were amazing and fantastic, working on a variety of different solutions. However, I noticed that during a lot of these discussions at New York Climate Week, Davos, for instance, London Climate Week, even San Francisco Climate Week, that all of the discussions were based on the mitigation side of things. Your decarbonization, your emissions reduction, things like electric vehicles, sustainable energy, how we combat that with new sources of renewables. But no one was really talking about the locked-in effects of climate change now or adaptation. Besides a few examples, like your darlings of the spaces, Climate X's, Mitigas, your climate risk companies that have already raised a large amount of money. And a lot of the talking points were from sort of the policy side of things. And I wanted to get really involved within the action side. I wanted to invest in early stage companies. I saw some of these VCs talking about this space. And I noticed that within climate tech investing, there was this huge white space with less than, I think, 10 pure players, and you could probably back this up, 10 pure player adaptation tech funds out there. And so I wanted to be part of that new discussion. I launched the ADAPT earlier this year, which is a small newsletter focused on climate adaptation tech entrepreneurs and investors, so builders in the space and also those backing them. And that really develops a fascination with the tech coming through that was helping industry and society deal with this risk. In particular, I noticed that the pest invasive species and biological section had no one working on it from an investment standpoint, but had a lot of deal flow coming through that when grouped together fell under this terminology. So that's why I wanted to start up Root Capital. And I think getting into venture investing was the sort of natural next step from networking and media and sort of sales and leveraging the experience, sort of customer facing elements of that. I understood a lot of pain points and pressures as they were trying to expand and navigate different geographical boundaries and connect with different investors. And from the investor standpoint, I understood a lot about the types of startups that they were looking to invest in and some of the problems they were finding with particular startups in particular sectors. And as I mentioned, there's sort of the huge white space for investing into climate adaptation tech as no one was talking about it, especially with temp risk as well. So that's essentially how I got into it.
Wonderful. Yes, I do believe there is an overlap between sort of media, events, networking, and VC, right? Because it's all people, right? It's all about connecting with people, telling the story, explaining the thesis. And also when it comes to scouting out companies, but also scouting out potential investors, it's also kind of understanding their backgrounds and understanding what makes them tick, right? So having that background in media and networking, I think, is very helpful there. And I do recommend my listeners read the ADAPT, and I'll put a link in the show notes. But I wanted to know what your perceptions are of, as kind of an outsider to investing, an outsider to kind of like this kind of world, what you think's going right and what you think's going wrong in terms of how the investment community, especially the early stage investment community, is approaching climate adaptation technology. What are the blind spots that might have? What do you think are the frameworks that have kind of been whipped up over the last few years, the kind of intellectual capital that's underpinning a lot of these new funds and new events and new initiatives in climate adaptation? It'd be refreshing to get your perspective as a sort of outsider coming in.
In terms of the sort of adaptation space more widely, I mean, just to start off with, there's a huge gap in terms of adaptation funding versus mitigation funding. I think 10% of climate tech funding goes toward adaptation startups. And I think, look, at the end of the day, there are lots of different taxonomies out there because it is a new space and because different VCs are trying to attract in LPs as well as sort of public NGO bodies that are trying to put more philanthropic capital into the space. And you have to cut and slice the deal flow and the terminology in a way which gives you the most deal flow as a VC. That's what the end game is. And also where you can see the exit opportunities. Convective, Mazarine, Tailwind as sort of pure play adaptation companies, Adaptus coming through now, Resist VC in Germany, all have very specific theses within this space. And I think that enables them to go very deep into particular areas and know all the players in the field. They see deal flow earlier than generalist funds. They know the potential exit better than generalist funds. And they can guide their portfolio companies better than these generalist funds because they really, really understand. I think some of the issues that I see within adaptation is often not a sort of communication. We've had our sort of back and forth on LinkedIn about adaptation versus resilience. Does it matter if people use different definitions of it? I sort of go back to the point that do what makes sense for your organization. Personally, from an Uproot standpoint, adaptation is the process and resilience is the outcome. But that just makes it sort of clear for us and for potential LPs coming into the fund. I don't think you can have resilience tech because it's an outcome. I think adaptation technology. Again, some will disagree with that. I've also
tell that to McKinsey. They just came out with their report saying climate resilience tech, and everyone was like, what are you talking about? We'll see how that works.
We'll see. And another problem is sort of, how do you measure adaptation? I've seen lots of different approaches and to do this. Obviously, the BCG and Temasek report made some effort. For us, we're constantly considering ways in which we can measure PIB risk being remediated or prevented. So stuff like economic damages, which have been prevented, or population reduction, or costs saved versus chemical and traditional approaches. And these another problem is that PIB risks and actual and other adaptations, so other climate risks, are both global and highly localized. So within the PIB risk space, you could be talking about invasive brown snakes that affect the island of Guam, and that's a completely different risk to quagga mussels that are in Idaho affecting the Great Lakes and river systems. It's completely different, but they are both PIB risks, and they both are affected by a change of climate. And I think that's why you need to be such a specialized fund within this space, is because if you're not, then you're not only dealing with a wide variety of climate-induced threats, you also have to then navigate and go down into each specific hazard and deal with global versus specific in those. And I just think for one fund, that's too much bandwidth. And I know other practitioners in the space feel similarly to this, and we've seen that reflected in the amount of specialized funds there are versus generalized funds. And it would be interesting to talk to a number of mitigation funds that are starting to come into adaptation as we blast past 1.5 degrees C and it becomes more of an obvious investing opportunity, and see how they're looking at this space.
One concern I have is that there is a lot of focus on the adaptation side in the VC space on the kind of software solutions, right? The diagnostics, as you might call them, the data dashboards, spatial imaging, etc. All this stuff is very important, and it's important because you can't manage what you can't measure. But also because in a world of constrained resources, if you have the insights to know where you can have the most effective physical intervention, right? Whether it is like spraying pesticides in a certain area of your crop field, or whether it is like installing some sort of membrane or filter in a certain part of a water network to prevent certain invasive species getting in. I understand the value there. But one concern I have is that you build this market for software and data, and then there isn't, though, that kind of pipeline of hardware companies that's coming up in the rear to actually provide the interventions that are needed that the data and software companies point to, right? So I'm just wondering, like, even though you're focusing on this kind of diagnostic side, are you seeing much in the way of like hardware interventions, you know, companies that are specializing in fancy pesticides or fancy new ways of building sewer networks and piping systems to deal with invasive species? Can you talk about that hardware side of it a little bit?
Actually, I would slightly disagree with that point. I think from our side, deep tech is just as attractive as software. As AI is enabling faster and cheaper replication of features and becomes harder to differentiate between solutions, it's sort of reducing the value of these sort of tech and the classic SaaS-based model. They lack sort of sticky solutions, something that defines them versus the competition. You know, we've seen so many different vibe coding apps like Lovable and Cursor come out, and there's hardly any differentiation between them. I think with deep tech, and we're seeing a sort of renaissance of deep tech, falling back of a lot of climate tech VCs to this in the hard tech space, is that I think with four key sort of characteristics that make up, it becomes a rather attractive opportunity for a lot of funds. It's the technical side of it. You know, you have deep IP, years of research that create moats around the type of technology that companies are producing. You've got control over the supply chain and the logistics side. It's quite capital intensive. And so with a lot of adaptation startups within our potential portfolio, we would be advising them to take use of a lot of sources of non-dilutive funding to help them scale. Venture capital is a fantastic vehicle for backing innovative early stage companies that are potentially high risk. But at the same time, they're quite capital intensive, and they will need non-dilutive sources of funding. And there are more and more programs out there that are helping adaptation tech startups within the PIB risk vertical scale without dilution. A couple that come to mind are sort of ARIA's Engineering Ecosystem Resilience Project in the UK. There's Horizon Europe in the EU, sort of the European Innovation Council, which has helped a number of startups that we're potentially looking at the moment, as well as DARPA in the US, coming at it from a sort of a national security point of view. The Ag Cross BTO program, which I think is Biological Technologies Office, has come up surface, and that's really interesting because there's a lot of companies coming through there. And then also the sort of final one is geopolitical sort of national security. So a lot of these companies have a sort of national security and resilience relevance, especially from the ag tech side. We're looking at a number of hard tech solutions. So as you mentioned, biologicals, biopesticides, so microbials, biochemicals, transgenics, RNAi are all hard tech, if you will. mechanical and robotical removal. So biofouling is a huge issue that we found on the hulls, removing the sort of barnacles and potentially invasive species on the bottom of the ships, as well as sort of coatings for supply chain and transportation and logistics. Cold chain technologies are particularly frail as the climate warms. The sort of differentiation in temperature as you're transporting goods from, let's say, Africa to the US or Europe can cause an increase in pests to manifest as you're transporting that crop. Could it, maybe it's avocados, maybe it's pineapple, but that's another hard tech solution we're looking at. Gene editing itself as well. So specialty chemistry solutions like pheromones too. So we're looking at a number of different hard tech solutions to combat PIB risks, and we think it's quite an attractive proposition. A lot of them will also be quasi software plays too. So on the smart insect monitoring side, you've got TrapView, companies like TrapView and Spotter and that are using smart IoT, so, and Scout Labs that are using sort of smart IoT sensing and a physical asset that categorizes the pests on specialty crops, for instance, and in forestry. And then they'll have an AI analytics platform to analyze what those pests are, what the geographical variation of them over an orchard, for instance, is, how many there are in a particular area. And then that feeds back to a sort of SaaS-based dashboard. So there's a number of different solutions that are combining both software and hardware. I think with adaptation, you're going to need a hardware element because it's a sort of problem rooted in physical manifestations.
Well, you've helped me reset my priors there then, because from my perspective, there seems to be a lot of, as I said, software and data companies in climate adaptation and less on the hard tech side. But it's great to hear about all those solutions and how there is this understanding that there needs to be a linkage between the software and the hardware to create kind of holistic adaptation solutions for businesses. Now, I want to get into like how current sort of corporate behemoths are kind of dealing with PIB risks, because presumably some of the companies that you invest in, you're going to hope that they get acquired by some of these large agribusinesses like Bayer, like Corteva, etc. And I'm wondering, like, what's your observations been, if you've made many observations, of how the big incumbents are already dealing with PIB risks, right? Is it kind of a more brute force in terms of like they've got the balance sheet, so they're doing things maybe inefficiently, but they're still dealing with these issues in a way that works for them? Or do they have blind spots themselves, which you're hoping that the companies that you invest in and back can help meet? What's your impressions of how corporate incumbents are dealing with PIB risks right now?
I think the sort of scale and intensity of mounting PIB risks are moving faster than corporates can adapt to them. And we've seen this in a number of sectors, not just agribusiness. And they're constantly looking for new solutions and innovations to come through. I think one good example of this that not a lot of people would sort of pin as a climate adaptation technology, which is BioPhero, which was an acquisition by FMC, I believe, in 2022 for about $200 million USD. And they produce pheromones for insect control in row crops like corn, for instance. And one of the pests that they were dealing with was something called fall armyworm, which is a particularly nasty invasive species. And it's getting worse because of the climate change. It increases the frequency of the outbreaks and it poses a real food security risk. So these are staple crops, right? Traditional IPM is really failing and they need new solutions coming through. I think that's a really good example of one acquisition one of these big ag companies has made. And we talk about agribusiness a lot as having poor exit market. Here is one example, which I think is just as much a climate adaptation play as much as it is an agribusiness play. We've seen, obviously, Corteva has split into sort of two companies recently. They've divided, I think, their seed and crop protection businesses. And I think the sort of macro headwinds of this could go in multiple directions, but I've seen a lot of analysis to say that it's essentially sort of focus on more strategic capital allocation and growth opportunities. I mean, on the BCG and Temasek report, agricultural inputs were on that top right quadrant, if you remember, of investable opportunities versus urgency and need and current sort of hyper realm solutions. So yeah, I think sort of traditional big ag is really looking at these up and coming solutions, biologicals, precision agriculture, GM crops, as new solutions coming through. And I think they're moving away from sort of nice to haves potentially, like alternative meats and your sort of food tech, and going back again to that sort of survival. How can they actually help farmers and growers who are, let's be honest, the staple of all of this, deal with mounting PIB pressures? But we're not just servicing agribusiness, I will say. One of the other sectors that a lot of our portfolio companies would be looking to exit in and service is your traditional pest control companies. They've been quite active in acquisitions recently. Rentokil and Anticimex and Rollins have all made acquisitions of smaller pest control companies, and they're actually going sort of horizontally, expanding them into sort of platform plays. A lot of them are owned by PE companies that are experts in this sort of roll up and then bolt on strategy approach. And what we're seeing with many of them actually is that now moving toward vertical integrations instead of horizontally. So they're looking at how they can make efficiencies in their business through new technological solutions, for instance, like IoT sensing and smart pest technologies and traps, instead of sort of bolting on new pest control companies. They're making the whole problem more, whole solution stack more efficient. We've seen sort of private equity acquisitions in adjacent industries, like Stanley Capital's acquisition of Cipro in 2024, I believe, which was a sort of specialty chemistry company helping lakes deal with sort of harmful algal blooms as a result of eutrophication and red tides. And they themselves have bought sort of solutions help with their platform. So Green Eyes helps sort of full service environmental health monitoring as part of this sort of bolt-on platform play. And I believe we'll start to see more and more of those acquisitions within the space as these risk companies become more developed and private equity can sort of bolt them on into existing platforms and integrate them into sort of current solutions. And it's now, I believe, is the right time for investments like this. We're predicting the market, I suppose, before it's taking off. And as I mentioned earlier, for a number of different reasons, for that invasion debt idea is one of those. And I think this is going to get a lot worse, unfortunately, before it gets better. And it's only when it starts to get worse that people wake up to this issue. And I believe that will be soon, unfortunately. And we're going to need these new solutions and innovations coming through to help industry and society deal with this risk.
Yes, sadly, I agree with your forecast there as well. Like, things have to be taken to a crisis point before a massive reallocation of capital and resources takes place. But what I think interesting about what you just said there is that there's clearly multiple vectors for startups, early stage companies in the space to find growth and to find exits, right? Whether it is through these PE roll-ups, whether it is being acquired by a large agribusiness or invested in by a large agribusiness's VC. So there seems to be lots of potential avenues for profitability and success for some of these companies, which may not be true of some other sectors as well, right? Like, I think about all the AI companies that have started up recently, that kind of pure play AI, thin layers of innovation on top of OpenAI's APIs. Then you think, well, okay, if everybody's doing them and there's only a certain number of people who are going to buy them, how are they all going to survive? Whereas in this case, there's multiple different venues for these companies to survive and thrive. So finally, we're recording this in October. You said Uproot just started in September. You're currently organized as an angel syndicate, so presumably doing very, very small ticket sizes. But what do you see the next 12 months looking like for you in the ideal scenario?
Well, as we all know, that the sort of fundraising environment is quite tough at the moment. But yeah, as an emerging fund manager, one of the best things you can do in this space is to build your track record. And with a fund like Uproot, I think people are going to be really interested in the deals that we're looking at because it's such a new sector. And because it sounds so esoteric, even though, as we've just talked about for the last half an hour, I don't think it actually is. So we're trialing out deals at the moment using SPVs to do a number of angel deals. We're leveraging an expert network. So a lot of the angels in our Uproot network and in the syndicate are sort of ex-big ag, or we're looking actually at a lot of sort of ex-pest control executives to come in, and they can really help the startup both grow economically and could also make the right hires as well. And they've been in the business before, so they know the intricacies of the space and they can really support the startup production through that process as we get into Series A. We're looking at seed and pre-seed, as I mentioned, small ticket sizes in the region of anything from 25 to 75, 80K, maybe 100. Mm. And going into the new year, we'd again only be sort of pre-seed and seed. It would be a small fund. We haven't put a target on close yet because we're keeping our options open. We're hopeful that because we're a specific fund and we will be a micro fund, be an easier environment to raise in because it's such a specific niche. We find LPs that really understand the problem. They could be agricultural families, businesses with the vested interest in the space, or companies strategically that want to see new innovation come through, that have a sort of investment arm or would like a sort of investment arm they don't currently have. We're hoping that the fundraising won't be necessarily as tough as a generalized fund trying to come into the space for the first time. It's focusing on a number of different hazards like wildfires, but also heat and flood risk, and earthquakes, etc. So we're really trying to narrow down our approach, and we think that'll draw specific institutional LPs to us and will hopefully raise easier.
And are you thinking global in scope? I mean, you're based in the UK, so are you trying to raise money from overseas, or and also are you looking to invest in companies all over the place, or mainly in UK and Europe?
We're looking globally at the moment. Europe obviously is right on our doorstep, and most of the companies we've been looking at are European focused to begin with. But the US has a huge problem with pest invasive species and biological risk that's only getting worse. A number of innovations are coming through there, so we're naturally being drawn to the US. Israel has been on the forefront of climate adaptation, especially in the water tech space. but also another risk like mosquitoes for a while. So there's a number of technological innovations coming through there. And I think those are the three main geographical focuses to begin with. However, South America, for instance, is particularly strong in the biopesticide biological realm because the conditions there are perfect for those type of solutions to be practiced and piloted on farms. So that's an area that we're looking at as well. We don't want to spread ourselves too thin. Again, we're going to be a smaller fund and we're a specific niche as well. We are looking at those three and then a potential fourth with South America added on.
Well, it sounds like you're clear-eyed about the challenges, but I think you also have a very strong investment thesis. You have a very good understanding of the market as it stands and a game plan. And it all comes down to the execution now and whether the world wants to play on your side or play against you, it seems. But I'd be very impressed talking to you, Will, and getting to know you over the last few months and understanding myself a little bit more about PIB risk and about climate adaptation in this context. So I wish you the best of luck. I look forward to following your successes and your trials and travails and seeing how it grows. And we'll keep in touch, okay? For now, thanks very much.
Thanks, Larry.
Climate Proofers is a Climate Proof Media production. It is produced and presented by me, Louis Woodall. Subscribe to the Climate Proof newsletter by going to climateproof.news/subscribe. And to learn more about the publication, feel free to reach out directly using our LinkedIn page. Goodbye for now.